you to the AYT Information Hour, hosted by Miss Tammy Battaglia. But before she gets to start tonight, she had asked me to do this song before she gets started tonight. So I just thought I'd stop by to do it for her.
My good friend Luther for that wonderful
introduction. Luther is my favorite blues man and founding member of LT and the Blues Express. They're currently number one blues genre here in Cleveland and in the top 100 nationwide. Their latest album, One Night Stand, will be available on iTunes shortly. But if you can't wait until then, contact me for other ways of getting this album before its official release. Also, welcome and thank you for tuning in to all the listeners here today. We appreciate your interest and participation in our effort. I'd also like to remind listeners that the thoughts and opinions expressed during this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of myself or RETargeted.com. We're here every Saturday trying to educate the public and victims so that we can bring an end to this blatant human rights violation that so many people are facing today. We'll open up the lines for questions and comments from our listeners in the second hour. So be sure to stick around for that. Archives of the show and Jeremy's 9-part series are available at talkshoe.com. Just type AYT into the search bar from that website and you'll find the recordings there. Don't forget to register for Jeremy's website at retargeted.com so we can hear your input anytime you feel like offering it. I'd like to personally thank the targets who stood and spoke to the Bioethics Commission on Wednesday the 18th. Your bravery and testimony is valuable to me and to everyone on this planet. If we don't change what's happening, God only knows what the ramifications will be on a mass scale. I can't thank you enough for speaking on Wednesday. The archives are now available at bioethics.gov website, so please check that out, make copies of it, and let's continue to get the word out to as many people as we can, including legislators and anyone else who has the power to make a difference. That includes citizens, neighbors, anyone who will listen. Now I'll pass the mic to Jeremy for today's interview. Jeremy, take it away.
Thank you. So how's the end of the world treating you?
Not bad. I know Brenda wants to experience the end of the world with me, but I'm not sure which time zone that's going to be taking place in. So, you know, I guess we'll...
I think it's Eastern. I think it's going to be happening during the show. That's the idea.
All right. That's very, very exciting. Now I'm even more excited than I was a minute ago.
Yeah, but of course we all know that's nonsense. The end of the world is actually at the end of 2012.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Yeah. But you know what's funny about that is I've been noticing my whole life I've been hearing that the end of the world is going to take place on one day or the other, and it just doesn't seem to happen. I keep hoping, but, you know, then I wake up and I'm here.
Yeah, that's true. So for those of you who are not familiar with my background with Tammy, I'm already familiar with many of the details of her life. We were actually roommates for about a year, in a 3-bedroom apartment. She got the master bedroom. I got the second best room. We moved out, or I moved out, at the beginning of this year. It was a financial strain on both of us, but it seemed necessary at the time. She was hoping for custody of her kids. Hasn't gotten that yet, but that's all going to come out in this interview. Her life is an encyclopedia of abuse. Anything that you can imagine, it's happened to Tammy. She is involved in a legal battle, and they have used things that she said about targeting in court before. So certain kinds of questions are off limits at this time. All right, let me just start in with the questions, Tammy. So a few years ago, you had amnesia, right?
Right.
Okay, how'd that happen?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I'm not really totally sure how it happened, to be completely honest. I was selling Pampered Chef at the time, and I started selling it to get my hands on the Pampered Chef things first, the products that they sell, because I thought they were great. And then the next goal would be to, you know, build up a savings of my own so that when the time came, when my kids were all grown, I would exit the marriage and have a nice little nest egg doing something I like doing, which I was being a kitchen consultant. I absolutely loved it. Well, I did a show for a friend of mine from college. And while I was there, I had been up all night preparing for the show and, you know, taking care of 2 young kids, because this was in 4, so my daughter was 2 and my son was 4. Mm-hmm. So I took care of them all day and also prepared for the show. And I ended up, after they went to bed, I stayed up all night, kind of not intentionally, but then I took care of them up until the time my husband got home from work and I went off to the show. Well, so I went off there and I did it, and it was really fun because we were friends from college, and we were friends all through college. We were at, you know, like the orientation together. Mm-hmm. And so we had a couple of drinks, and I ended up calling my husband and saying, look, you know, I was up, and he knew I was up all night too. And I said, you know, I've been up all night, I've been preparing for that show, and now we've had a couple drinks, there's no way I can drive. But he had to be at work early the next day, so I said, don't worry, you know, we're going to all go to bed now, and we'll set a clock. She's going to, you know, set the clock for me so I can be up and back home in time for you to get to work. No problem. He didn't want me on the road either, because here I'd had a couple drinks, and I was up all night. So I go to sleep on her couch, and the next thing you know, I'm waking up in the neurointensive care unit at the hospital.
So the way it looks to someone listening in on this is you did go out drinking and driving.
Well, I guess. But
that's
if you're me and you were in the situation, like even my friend came in later on after I'd regained enough of my memory. I had regained like the last 3 years of memory by the time people came in to visit me and see me in the horrible condition I was in because I was, you know, pretty well beaten from head to toe. But she said, how did this happen? And she felt very responsible, you know, and she said, I don't understand this because she cleaned after I went to sleep on the couch, which took no time at all because I'd been up for so long and had a couple of drinks, not enough to put me into a blacked out situation or, you know, like falling down drunk. I didn't have that much to drink. I was just exhausted. So I fell asleep right away and I'd been asleep for hours before she went to bed. And she said, how did this happen? I don't understand, you know. So it didn't make a whole lot of sense, and that's why I say I really don't know. But when I first woke up in that hospital, I didn't know anything, you know, nothing. My name, that I had a husband or children, nothing at all, except that, you know, I had just been in and out of consciousness, and people were telling me I was in a horrible car accident.
Okay, one more detail, if I can interrupt here. This horrible car accident, it must have gotten into the newspapers, right?
No. There was no newspaper article about it. And later on, when I started to really regain memories, about a year after that, because for that first year after it, I just...
What year was this?
This was in 2004.
Okay.
I went for the whole story I was being told. I never questioned it, and I just kind of tried to make amends. I felt very horrible that I would put myself in that position, having my two young kids. I would never behave that way. That's why, you know, I just felt so ashamed and all this. Well, I ended up getting my, and you know that story of how I ended up retrieving memories and being triggered.
Okay, why don't you tell us what triggered your recovery? Was it anything in particular, anything you can talk about on this call?
No, I really can't talk about that publicly.
Okay.
I mean, I've told you the story about different
times. I do know the story,
So I really can't go into that detail, but it was intentional that I have a full recollection. People were making sure with different triggering things that was going to happen. And it was unique people to the time in my life. So it was very strange what I went through that year. But when I did start to recollect, I saw pictures of the van, which was brand new. And I told you that story about how about a month before that, I got two perfectly flat tires on that van on the passenger side. Brand new, brand spanking new van, 2 months old, right out of the factory. And both tires blew out at the same time. And it was just really strange later on when I would look back on that. But no, so there was not a newspaper article. And when I later investigated after my memory started to come back, I went to the police and I got the police report. And I tried contacting the people who were listed as witnesses, who allegedly lived in the house across the street from the gas station where this took place, where I was allegedly going 70 to 90 miles an hour straight into a tree, which is exactly out of character for me. I don't drive that way, no matter what. If I've had a couple of drinks, there's been no way. I've never put myself in that kind of danger. So, I followed up also with the gas station owner who was listed as a witness. So he had no idea. He had never heard of any accident. He didn't witness any accident. And he was the owner at that time. Well, the other people listed who lived in the house, they don't even exist. I can't find them. So.
Right. Okay. That's interesting, that discrepancy. One more thing before I move on to a new line of questioning. People in your life, friends and family, told you that you'd been in a car accident. Well, how do they reconcile what they're telling you with what is actually on record? Do you think that they were lying to you?
I think that they didn't know. I think they heard that I was in the car accident, and none of us could make it add up at first. I think even for them, it might have been a little strange at the time, just because different people, just because it was a little while before I could have visitors.
Right. Okay.
Because of the, you know, what was going on.
Okay, so now let's get on to the post-amnesia period, which is actually kind of like the pre-amnesia period, because you started recovering memories at some point, and those were memories of before the accident. What kinds of memories did you recover that you're willing to talk about?
You're talking about from my childhood. And
I mean, how much have you recovered, I guess, is the first thing I would ask.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, and I thought, you know, 5 years ago, I said that I had recovered probably 90% of my memory. I really thought I had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then a couple years later, I thought, okay, now I've probably recovered 90%.
Right.
And now I feel like I've recovered about 90% probably, you know. So who knows how much I've really recovered. Recovering from amnesia is, it's difficult. I always describe it as taking a file box full of perfectly organized files, hundreds and hundreds of them, 1,000 files all in there, and it's your whole memory and your whole life and everything you know how to do, everything you know about yourself and other people. Take it up to the top of the Empire State Building and throw it off, and then take the stairs back down to the bottom level, and then you got to go around, find the box, find the file folders, find the files, put them all back in place again. You know, it's very difficult.
Yep. Right.
It's difficult. And one target that I spoke to very early on, I think the second person I talked to was Richard. He was handling the 800 number for FFCHS at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told him about the amnesia, he said something that at the time I didn't really get it, but now I do. He said, oh, so this amnesia is to discredit you. And now that I've been recovering from it for so long, I can see the validity of that opinion. Because
things looked different to you a few years ago when you didn't have most of your memories back.
Right. And as I regain
and now
I have a very good understanding. That's why I'm even willing to talk publicly.
A couple years ago, my
understanding was not good enough for me to be able to conduct an interview properly because I did not have enough memory to understand what position I'm in currently.
Right, because like Richard was hinting, your story changes, so people just kind of stop paying attention to you. That's what you're getting at?
Well, as I add more pieces to the puzzle, I get a better understanding.
Right. Okay. It remembers stuff that didn't happen, right?
What do you mean?
Okay, you remember stuff, and you've recovered memories, and then you turn up evidence or paper trail supporting those memories? Any of them, just like your marriage certificate, you suddenly remember that who you're married to, and you turn up a marriage certificate. I'm just asking.
Oh, well, there is a marriage certificate from my marriage, yeah.
Yeah.
But other things, no, I have not been, and I actually haven't had the resources to go out digging and looking.
Is that something you'd like to do?
Yeah, I would like to do that, and I'd like to do it for a long time before I really talk about it.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
There is a lot of information that needs to be, you know, straightened out and validated. You know, like I know we're just supposed to say I don't need validation, but there's some things I would like to just prove or disprove just for my own well-being. Because, you know, I've been through a pretty intense psychological operation where I had a lot of people telling me a lot of different things while I was trying to recover from amnesia at the same time. With threats on top of that, because there was a never-ending threat during all of that recovery, that I was going to lose my children forever and that people were going to kill me. You know, there was
okay.
a death
well,
threat.
Yeah, well, let me go into an example of something that happened in your past that you recovered memories of after the accident. When you and your brother were subjected to psychiatric experimentation in your teen years, and you remember that, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And other
how'd that happen?
To answer the first question, admit that, yes, we were incarcerated, basically,
mm-hmm.
in mental institutions, and him much, much more than me, and for ridiculous reasons, like that didn't really make sense. I think it was a lot of manipulation, and not my parents were being manipulated, is what I'm really driving at, because he had been suspended from school for smoking a cigarette and being caught. And, you know, most of the kids, a lot of the kids in that town smoked cigarettes at that time. He was 14, I think, or 13 or 14. So my parents, he thought that telling them that he had experimented with pot would, I don't know what the heck he was thinking, but he thought that would, like, kind of lessen the blow because they were just devastated that he was suspended. So they discussed it and ended up putting him into a drug rehabilitation place. They were saying that, you know, maybe he has a drug problem. They want to have him evaluated because he admitted to experimenting with marijuana. The people at the drug place said that he needed to be admitted into the hospital, that he had a problem. And I know my brother, you know, there was nothing wrong with him before this. He was just a normal kid in this town, you know, especially in the neighborhood that we were living in. Mm-hmm. Like, all the kids were kind of the same, and that's how I think how it is from town to town. We were all in the same economic field. There were a couple of cops living on the street and tons of kids, whatever. So he's in this drug rehab now, and then they end up putting him into a mental institution, saying that he had mental problems. So my parents went along with that, and then they put him into a long-term facility based on the doctor's recommendation. And I was seeing my parents the whole time during this because I would go and visit my brother, you know, with them. They were not happy about all this. They weren't sure, but they thought they should trust the doctor. So they did. And eventually what happened, he was in the hospital for about 6 months in this long-term thing, and he kept trying to break it, you know, which anybody who's been in one of those places understands why you want to break out, especially if you're a kid, a young kid like that. And you don't want to be locked up and labeled and drugged and all these things that they're doing, tied to beds and, you know, whatever. The doctors, my parents wanted to get him out, and the doctor said no, that they wanted to try experimental drugs for his condition, which he had no condition going in. I can vouch for that 20,000 times over. Mm-hmm. My parents didn't want to go for it, and they said, well, if you take him out now, it's going to cost you $3,000 a day for the time that he's been in here, and he'd already been in for 6 months. Now, my dad was a cop, you know, and he was a patrolman. He was just, you know, he was on patrol. My mom was a clerk. They didn't know what to do. They had to talk about it, right? But they discussed it. They can't afford that kind of money, and they went ahead and signed the paper. And they said the doctors had already said they wanted experimental treatments to combat his condition. So this is the manipulative tactics that they'll use to bring somebody into a life of being a guinea pig.
Right. So parents can just sign their kids away like this, and the kids don't have any say in it.
No say at all. None. No. You're treated like a caged animal usually when that sort of thing is happening. And then there's a certain amount of shame that I'm sure goes along with that for the parents who do make that kind of horrible decision.
You were also signed away for this kind of experimentation?
Well, you know, the kid who signed away is not invited into the meeting.
Right, so you don't know what happened, right?
I have no idea because they won't tell you anything. Just like even adults who are incarcerated by these psychiatrists, they are not told what's going on with themselves. You can question and question and get more and more upset. That just feeds what they want.
Right.
You know, the more upset you get, the more they can say you're having erratic behavior, even though you're incarcerated.
You're having an episode, right.
Yeah.
Episode of being upset that you're being thrown in prison, right.
Yeah. And drugged, and they can do anything they want. It's so important not to sign those papers. If anybody ever wants to put you in one of these places, don't say, yes, I agree with this, and I'm going in voluntarily, because they will try to convince you that it'll be better for you if you just say that you agree and you're going in voluntarily. They know you're in a very vulnerable position. You've just had everything stripped off of you, your clothing, everything. They put you in a hospital gear. They take blood and do all kinds of different stuff to you. They insist that you take drugs, and then they feed you a line that, hey, it's in your best interest if you just sign this paper.
Right.
So be very careful, folks, especially if you're a target, on what you sign and read everything.
So
go ahead.
Would you mind saying what kinds of things they did to you in the psychiatric facility? Not something you're willing to talk about this time?
No, because it's No, I don't think I should talk about what happened when I was a kid in those places.
Yeah.
It's pretty disgusting and disturbing, as you know. You've heard the story.
Yeah.
So what they did to me was very disturbing. I don't like reliving it.
Okay,
I don't
that's
like.
Fine.
Yeah, I don't even like telling my what happened to my brother. It's just so upsetting. But, you know, it's important to let people know what these people are really up to and what they're doing. This has
okay.
been my goal since I was a kid to get this information out.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's not talk about that this time. But you do have evidence that you and your brother were sent into his institution, some sort of paper trail, right?
I have no paper trail. I can't afford to go and get those kind of records released because, first of all, I don't even know how to go about it, but I know that it costs money, and you know my financial situation.
Yeah, sure.
And it's been like that and worse since well before I met you, you know, half a decade. I've been, at some points I had no income, and, you know, there's no way I can pursue that at this point, so I don't really think about that.
But the records are there. If you can just scrape up the money to gather them,
no doubt they're there. And plus, other people just admit to it. I mean, I have other kind of verbal recognition to these sort of things.
That's what I'm talking about. Any kind of evidence. Okay, good. Would you say it's had a lasting effect on either of you?
Definitely. No doubt about it. My brother hasn't stepped foot outside in over a decade. I think it's going on 13 years now since he's put a toe outside. He has very bad Stockholm syndrome, and he has also become pretty abusive himself, and that's probably, I don't know, because of what he's been through. And that was something else I was telling you earlier this week, is I'll never forget when he finally just gave in, you know? He was fighting it. He was fighting, and he was still getting out. I was getting him jobs at different places that I worked. I was an administrator everywhere I worked, you know, pretty much, or assistant manager, something like that, so I could hook him up. And I would get him jobs, and we would work, and it was kind of good. Like, seemed like he might be able to break loose from this stuff. But my parents were always on top of him, especially my mother, more than anybody. And he was still kind of acting out because of that control, I believe. From what I witnessed. Finally, eventually, he just gave in and said that he would sign himself over, you know, if they would just leave him alone. And he did. He signed over medical power of attorney, signed over, he let them be his legal guardian, and he never stepped foot outside again, pretty much. And he lives at their house where I was living. This is why I was telling people in the beginning I was living with handlers, because they did, when I was just starting to recover memories in 2005, a year after the severe head injury, and the time in NICU when I'd lost my memory completely, they did manipulate me into signing over medical power of attorney. And several times after that, my mother suggested that I let her be my legal guardian. And she kept telling my children that I will never get out of her house, even though I was telling my children, look at this. You know, these people are willing to help us get a colonial, and we might have to share the place with another single mom and her kids, but everybody screamed and blah, blah, blah. And there's, you know, it's we might be able to get out. And her next thing would be, your mother will never get out of my house. You should really let me be your legal guardian.
Yeah.
And, you know, you witnessed how manipulative and just over the top situation is.
I've met your parents and your brother in person, and, yeah, they pick up on anything negative right away, anything that can be spun in a negative way right away. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and to scapegoat it over to me. That's always the goal. I'm the scapegoat. I'm to blame for absolutely everything. And it's been that way since Phil Donahue and Sally Jesse Raphael educated me on what child abuse is. Ever since I understood what child abuse is, I am the scapegoat. Where I could have ended up the hero, but nope, I'm the scapegoat.
All right.
So that's where we go from there. That's the past, basically, in a nutshell. And it gets real hideous and ugly and disgusting when you start bringing other handlers into it. But I cannot go into any of that, just so we know going forward.
Yeah, okay. In the present day, you've got your two young children. You talked about them earlier.
a 9-year-old girl and an 11-year-old boy. You had them with a husband whom you're now divorced from. So what did you lose when things went bad, when you got targeted? Everything, right?
Oh, yeah, everything. He refused to leave the marital home, and I slept on the couch for 7 months trying to negotiate with him, saying, look, I have a college degree. I was a very successful mom to the kids, you know, and it still was, except for some blowouts that were going on via him because he did not want the divorce at the time. And
basically, you lost a house, you lost all the furniture in the house, you lost the kids, your job.
Well, eventually I lost the kids, yeah, a few years later. I've now lost the kids. But at first I didn't because, you know, even now they're not accusing me of much. Like, they can't accuse me of being a drug addict or anything like that, so they have not. They can't accuse me of being an abuser because there's no evidence of that, and I'm not. So they can't really accuse me. They're saying that I'm dangerous in the fact that I have a mental illness that could be mentally damaging to my children. Now, they can't say what that mental illness is, so the judge ordered a, because they're not psychiatrists or doctors, they're just saying this, their opinion, my ex-husband.
Right. So and, how many psychiatric evaluations have you gotten connected to the custody of your children?
Well, I've had one evaluation.
Okay.
Really. But the people who are involved.
You've been there a whole bunch of times. You've been seeing these people.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw three social workers, two actually came to my apartment, one while you were still living here, as a matter of fact, and then the other one came twice after you'd moved out, and then also I saw a nurse who did a full physical with me and, a physical history, so we went through all that, and we had a nice conversation, too, while I was hanging out with her. Then I took a test with a psychologist, and I met with him three times, actually. The first time we just talked, and he got to know more of my story, which I'd already seen him one other time earlier, actually a couple other times, asking him, you know, should I have an evaluation? And he advised me the first time not to. He said that it was pretty obvious that the court was not on my side, and that if no matter what he found, the court would probably subpoena my records and find out whatever they wanted to find. He said his evaluation had never been denied in the past, but the judge was saying that I couldn't have an evaluation done there. I had to have it done at the Cleveland Clinic. So eventually it was after I went in and spoke in court, I was able to have the evaluation done at that place. So I went back to the same guy, and he remembered all that. I refreshed his memory at the first visit. At the second one, I took a 600-question test, and at the third one, I took a 150-some question test, and I went back to see him again for the results, and they were really good. You know, I don't have what he found was that I don't have a mental illness. I don't need drugs. That I have a bit of a, the hell is that, Jeremy?
You have a little distrust of the authorities. Can't imagine why.
Yeah, distrust of authority figures is what was found to be, you know, something that was a little bit of a discrepancy, but nothing major. And that he found that I was very honest. So that's what his thing was, and the bottom line, he went through some of my history also in his report, and then the bottom line was, I see no reason why Tammy should not have visitation with their children. I think she could handle this in a very reasonable way, and as she has in the past.
So all these people that you've seen in the past 2 or 3 years to get evaluated for fitness of custody of your children, how many of them, they've all said you should be seeing your children, right?
Yeah, and the next one that I saw was a psychiatrist, and I saw her consistently, and I had also seen her 5 years earlier and 3 years earlier, and just to see, you know, if I needed something to help me sleep and this sort of thing. She's never thought that I needed medication or had a mental illness the entire time. And that's what she reported. And she said, I think that Tammy should have unsupervised visits with her children. So we had a psychiatrist, psychologist, three social workers, and a nurse. And the magistrate herself said that I should have unsupervised visits, and that was going to be her recommendation. Later on, she tried to double talk that, but I have a recording of that conversation. Mm-hmm. So she can double talk all she wants, and I've got the proof.
Okay, so what rationale is the judge using to keep you away from your kids at this time, after all these evaluations?
I don't know. The only thing that he puts in the docket or into his journal entry, his ruling basically, is that I have not fully complied with the court's order, and they will reevaluate my compliance after 8 more supervised visits.
Okay.
And in the meantime, I'm separated from my children for a second year during their birthday and Mother's Day. And this is during those 8 supervised visits where it blows my mind that this evaluation wasn't enough for the judge.
All right. We've gone over in this interview and, in person, how they take anything they want to see out of your past and use it against you selectively. Like, for example, your contact with the community of targeted individuals, including myself. What kinds of things have they used against you in court because of that contact?
You were there sitting. You were the only person in the audience that day.
Yeah.
And you and I actually had to go out in the hallway. The judge granted us a couple of minutes to discuss whether or not you were going to stay in the courtroom or you were going to take the stand.
Right.
And if you were going to take the stand, then you had to stay out of the courtroom during the proceeding.
So we
decided, so that you could witness it, that you would be in the audience instead of taking the stand. Because at that point, I had a stack of affidavits from different people that have, some of them witnessed the abuse that I'd gone through. Most of them had witnessed me being a very good mother to my kids. Some of them just witnessed my business skills and, as I am, and obviously not mentally ill.
But none of that was any good to the judge.
No, the judge would not accept those things. So then I take the stand, and I was questioned about what is freedom from covert harassment and surveillance, and why am I involved with that group?
And they actually started reading stuff that you posted to the harassment log, right? Yeah.
Right. And they were submitting it as evidence, things that I had submitted to the harassment log at FFCHS. And so they asked me what was gang stalking. And I said, well, you heard your client admitting to having his friends taking pictures of me in public. People are harassing me. Your client threatened to kill me right in front of my kids. This is gang stalking, when one or more people are harassing you and stalking you. I said, your client used to call me 17 times a day. So that kind of put the kibosh on that, because we had all seen my ex-husband admitting to, that dude had to stop that line of questioning, because I had evidence right there that day that I had
been stopped.
Yeah. So that put that away. But then they tried to question me about you and if you had a job.
Because I met you over the internet. Right.
They tried to say that we met over the internet, but I said no. I did not meet Jeremy over the internet. I met him at a conference for gang stalking victims in Cincinnati, Ohio. And then a friendship was formed through that first meeting. So I handled that one well, too, and they couldn't go on about how horrible you are. Even though they went ahead in the judge's ruling and said that I had not proven why you should be in my children's lives, even though they hadn't proved why you shouldn't.
for that courtroom meeting, I just want to let the listeners know. Yeah, I was there for the whole thing, and I wanted to hear what Tammy thought about it. Another detail that might not have come across is we didn't know what to expect. They were asking, they were suddenly putting this possibility of me standing up on the stand, and I hadn't even realized that this was a possibility.
And, of course, I had no idea what kinds of questions they were going to be asking. And regardless of how innocent you are, you don't want to be facing cross-examination without some sort of preparation in a courtroom. You don't want to be blindsided in that kind of situation. So that was part of the reason that we decided I should stand down at that time. They were ready to use the fact that no matter what I did, if I come up on the stand, they would have been asking me about my history,
right,
trying to portray me as a dangerous individual. I didn't come up to the stand, and that was used against me too, wasn't it? That was used against you.
No, it wasn't used against either of us. That never did come up again, whether or not we all wanted you to come and testify, because I really had thought at the time, even though this didn't come up either, it did because I tried to submit the affidavits. And remember I had made that statement of facts?
Right.
And the judge didn't want it. He was like, what do I need this for? Statement of facts. Well, don't you want to hear my side of the story? And then the other thing that was kind of screwed up was I was trying to get a hold of my friend who is also a witness to some of the abuse. And I said that I had a person who wanted to come in and testify tomorrow. And remember, he had started out telling me I had all of today and tomorrow to present my case. Well, as soon as I said, my friend can come in and testify tomorrow, and she has been a witness to this abuse, he said, no, we need to get this thing going. We need to speed this up. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So the cards were stacked against me from the beginning, and they have been for years, even before I met you. Back then, I didn't have any support whatsoever, nothing but the handlers that I lived with and that I described earlier. And other abusive people. That was all that was in my life. And the only two that weren't abusive were my kids, and they were, at the time, they were 9 and 7. Well, younger. They were like 6 and 8 when this all started. So, you know, you're going to turn to 6 and 8-year-old for support on a very adult, hideous, disgusting matter. Impossible.
Right.
So, yeah. So I didn't have any kind of support throughout the whole thing.
Okay, now today, how are you doing now, emotionally and financially?
Oh, wow. Financially, I'm doing much better. I was on unemployment for a little while after the second incident that we won't go into. In 2007, I lost my job. So
right.
I was finally able to get unemployment. They wouldn't give me unemployment because I had a disability. I couldn't physically work. I had to walk with a cane or crutches, and I was having several surgeries, and I was in the hospital for a long period of time. Finally, I was able to get the unemployment, and I saved almost all of it until I gathered up a pretty good nest egg, enough to where I felt comfortable moving out, you know, and having some loose change and then still the unemployment coming in. And that's when you and I hooked up, and I said,
right.
Hey, you know, you've got this situation, I've got this situation. We could improve our situation if we combined resources. And yeah, you agreed, so we did it. And that's a whole other story of what it was like getting here from Cincinnati and getting you from Cincinnati to here and all that stuff. And that was a roller coaster ride in itself. Huh? Everything's an adventure. I filed for all kinds of different assistance programs, and I was approved because I do have a physical deformity and disability that it causes me, you know, in my leg, where I can't stay on my feet very long without severe, well, I have the pain all the time, but it becomes severe if I'm on my feet for very long, and I get a lot of huge swelling and muscle deprecation that's obviously never coming back, and I could have a very bad surgery to give me even less mobility in my foot, and right now I'm supposed to get a brace. So physically, I'm still not doing great. But I'm better, and I can walk around without a cane and stuff for a limited period of time, but that's better than nothing, what I had before. I was in bed before. Couldn't get out of bed, and I had an IV and all that, PIC line and whatever. So that is way, way better now. And financially, I'm doing better because I am getting assistance because of these disabilities that were enforced on me.
Good, good. It's good that you're doing better. Closing things off, we're almost at 5 o'clock, so I might as well start in with the final three questions or your final three answers. What advice would you share with the TI community? A top three list.
Okay. The top one for me is that before I understood what I was going through, I did not know that I needed to gather evidence. Now, I wish I'd known because I had a lot more resources back then. I had a job, I had money, I had an income, but I didn't know I needed evidence. And I sure wish I would have known. So as soon as you do know, start gathering evidence and start getting recording devices and things to capture evidence, because that's what the police want. When I went to the police with death threats, they're the ones who advised me to get a little recording device, because if I were to bring the recording of the death threat to them, then they could do something about it. So I did do that, and the death threat stopped. I was getting them so much for a while there that even when they stopped, I was petrified.
Right.
I was terrified that I had two different people saying that they were going to murder me, and one of them was even telling me about other people who were plotting against me.
So taking recordings, either you get evidence or people start behaving, and that helps with the psychological trauma.
Oh, definitely, because, I could not take any more of those death threats. It was very scary having people tell you to your face. And sometimes even in front of my children, I was told, I will kill you myself, right in front of my kids in a church parking lot. My kids were petrified. That's when the police advised me to get that recording device,
right,
which I did. That's the first one, is gather evidence. It's necessary and we need it. And the second one is don't believe the hype. We're proof that not everyone has a price, I believe. You can get medical help and you can get help from law enforcement, and everybody isn't out here trying to destroy your life and hurt you. You know, I would never do those things. I don't have a price. And I'm proof in the pudding. You know, everybody. A lot of times we fall into that trap that anybody can be bought, anybody can, you know, but everybody can't. And there's lots and lots of people out there. My faith in humanity has been restored, is basically what I've got to say, is that there's more people out there, I believe, that would not hurt anybody in the way we're being hurt. There's more people out there that would not hurt us than there are that would for any amount of money, or hurt somebody else's children for any amount of money. These things are usually a natural thing in the person that's doing it, and they need help. It's a serious mental illness. I guess the third thing is that everybody doesn't know. And, you know, don't be afraid. Of course, we go over that on everyone. Don't, every one of these calls. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. Don't give in to fear. Because, you know, really at this point, what do we have to be afraid of? I know that's different for me to say, because like Jeremy was saying at the beginning, I've had kind of every kind of abuse a person can have, but once I kind of took control of myself and got very, very organized in my own life, which I needed to do for a long time, and I had a very hard time doing it because of the confusion and the abuse and just the torture. But finally, once I did take the bull by the horns and take the reins of my own chariot, things started coming together much, much better. I focused on myself and not on my attackers, because their threats are empty. Two people were threatening to kill me, and one of them was telling me about other people, but look, here we are. It's been 3 years since I bought my recording device. Well, no, it's been 2 years since I bought that recording device, and I don't get death threats anymore to my face, and I won't. I record my phone calls from people who've been threatening to me in the past and people who I don't know.
Yep.
And if anybody wants to threaten me, there's going to be a record of it, and you're going to be in trouble. So folks know that, and that has really made things a little bit better for me. So that's something I like sharing with people.
All right, good, good. I think we've got enough for the audience to work with. It's been about an hour. Let's turn it over to the audience. If anybody would like to ask questions, just press *8. We'll let you have the microphone.
Or even just a comment, not about me, would be fine, too.
Yep. Yep, doesn't have to be about Tammy. I'm sure Tammy would like it not to be about Tammy for once.
Sure, I would love that. I like to get other people's input, no doubt about it. So questions and comments are definitely welcome.
Yeah, it is a beautiful day outside, at least here in Ohio, probably elsewhere. So I'm not surprised not very many people have shown up. Got someone in Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hi, it's Linda.
Oh, hey, Linda. Hi.
I was just wondering, what are you going to pursue getting documentation of your past?
Yes,
when
I
you
am.
Can?
Yeah, and I have a couple of different Well, there's a couple of things in the works already. A friend of mine sent me something that I can't really go into great detail about right now because I just don't want to blow the whistle on what my plans are. I'm sure, you know, there's people that already know what I'm up to, but I can't really talk about that. But it's a little piece of my past that I would like to find out, and I've wanted to know for a while now. So I'm going to have one test done, but it's $200. And, you know, if I have $200, then I'm going to put it towards an attorney right now. So just as always, there's something that's going to hold me back from going down that road of trying to find out my history and my past. Now, if what was happening at the Bioethics Commission were to be effective, then, you know, I may have my file released from different organizations that have given me trouble in the past trying to get records from them. And if that were to happen, that would sure cut down my expense.
So are you feeling like you other than, you know, what we know of as gang stalking and the electronic harassment, do you feel like this went back to your childhood and that you were part of a government program from then?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. So when you say about getting things released if the Bioethics Commission works, then that would be government agencies releasing records?
Yes, that would save me a whole lot of time and effort and money.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
why I said when I testified in front of the commission, one of the statements I said was, in America, the land of the free, justice is not free. I need justice. I need proof. And it's going to cost me possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars to get that proof. I might have to, you know, do what James Walbert's done, hiring private investigators. And release of medical records is not cheap. And the last 6 years, I've had 18 surgeries.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's a lot of records to try and have released to me. And then the ones that I do have, I don't understand what the heck they say. We're talking about reports from neurologists and reports from all different kinds of people, and I don't even recognize a lot of the names from the medical records. You know, there's been so many people involved in this that I don't remember even ever seeing those people. Because,
names of,
you know,
doctors?
Yes, doctors and all kinds of medical professionals that are in my one record that I was able to have released years ago when I still did have resources and I was curious. But then I got so scared from the medical records, but from the threats that I was receiving that all I wanted to do was just kind of get away from it somehow and figure it out so I could get away from it. Why was all of this happening? Why were these people acting so strange? People I was supposed to be able to trust, and then other people who are supposed to be heroes to everyone, like doctors and law enforcement. Yeah, that was some tough stuff to try and sift through.
Now, I know that when I put in for FOIAs, they said that I would have to make payments, but I thought that there was a way that if you were indigent, you could get the FOIAs released for free.
Oh, I don't know about that, but that is something I'll definitely look into.
I know I was listening to something, and I can't remember what it was, but it had said that there was a way to get them free.
I can't imagine there wouldn't be, and that is very good information because that's something I've never thought about before. When I got these, every Department of Defense or CIA, any intelligence company out there, or agency, whatever you want to call these people, mafia, I call them, NSA, CIA, DOD. Those are the three. And the FBI, they don't respond. Now, they've given me some really strange, covert kind of things, but they won't respond to me otherwise. And if I call, as soon as I say my name, I get disconnected. And I have recordings of that. Yeah, so what happens is the intelligence companies send me back from my FOIA request, okay, we received your FOIA request and we want to take it seriously. And I'm not reading their, you know, direct letter at this point. It's in a box in my closet right now. But it says you need to send us a notarized proof of your identity, and also it'll cost so much per hour and so much per page. So they're trying to discourage me from getting that evidence. Now, everybody else I sent them to, because if you remember back in the day when Derek had that attorney, they
right.
had the FOIA request on them. I sent that out to everybody they had on that list. I think there was like almost 70 different agencies.
Right.
I sent it to every single one of them. And every one of them got back to me with, we have no record of you, except for the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the National Security Agency, who at the time, if you went down to my my system tray on my computer, and you brought up who was supplying my internet connection, it was supplied by a.oh.reg, and I have pictures of that. And
it was supplied by what?
It was nsa.oh.reg.
That was my internet
supplier. That was that, yes. So I knew that the government was involved in some way, but I couldn't put my finger on why, because at that point I really had severe amnesia. I hadn't
right.
remembered hardly a thing. I only knew about the last 5 years. And most of that time was spent in a very nice time, being a stay-at-home mom with my kids, with no looming divorce or anything.
Right.
So I only had like kind of 2 years of hell to build on there.
So you were never able to trace why that was NSA, that was your supplier?
No, never. I never even tried, actually. It just freaked me out.
Yeah. I think that's
And a lot of things were freaking me out at that time. I mean, the when I lived with the handlers for 4 years,
right.
things were very, very intense. The
yeah.
harassment was unbelievably intense. To the point they had to let me move out of there, otherwise I wasn't going to survive it. And the people doing this know that. And like I tell other people who think they're killing us, which I believe they're killing us slowly, I'll say this is a slow kill campaign. They're not killing us, because otherwise, if they wanted us dead, they would kill us right now, you know?
Yeah, no. They've invested too much money in us to just kill us.
Right, and many of us, they're making money off of us, too, at the same time. So, and that's a whole big, long story to get into of how they make money off of their slaves, because that's really what it boils down to for some of us. Like, you look back on what's happened to you, and much of my life has been spent, I've been sick, and I've been in the hospital, and I've been severely injured. I've been isolated intentionally. You know, even in childhood, I was in trouble all the time for stupid things, really. And I got much more severe punishments than my peer. Something that a peer of mine would get a 2-day grounding for, I would get a month grounding for. So everybody would be out roller skating, and I'd be trying to go to sleep.
Do you think that was part of your programming?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a trauma-based thing that I'm
right.
involved in. It goes back to very early childhood.
Right.
Which is about all I can say about it, really.
I know it's hard every time, you know, like when you find something like that and it says your internet connection, it does put you into such a tailspin, it's hard to follow up on it. I know that I have that happen to me. Like, I have to sit with things for a long time before I can go the next step.
Yeah, before you can carry on.
Yeah.
Doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to. Well, I have when I went to college, I minored in computers, and I've always had kind of an interest in computers. And my ex-husband's uncle actually had a computer programming business, and he was totally a cool guy. He died just recently, but he taught me a whole lot too about computers. And my mother-in-law had her master mouse, and she taught me even more than I already knew, which I knew a bunch about that kind of crap, too. So I know a lot about computers, and I know how to kind of get around the there's a lot of propaganda involved in computers with the need for virus software and malware and different things that pop up if you're on a internet connection, what to do and not to do. So I don't have a whole lot of internet problems. But sometimes, like everybody else, I got to clean up my computer and I've got to restart it, reset my server. I get those kind of things where I will get knocked completely off of the internet and I have to reset my server. So, yeah, I have computer tampering. I always have. But back in the day, I would get different search results than I was able to find at the library. So one day I took a screenshot of these things and printed them, and I went to the information desk at the library, and I said, Are you on a different Google than I am, Google search? Because I'm not getting the same results at home that I'm getting here. And this is when my internet provider was nsa.oh.reg. And so she would bring up whatever search I was going for and find that, yeah, it was definitely different than what I
have that getting. Now. I have that
yeah.
now. I go to, if I really, you know, want to do a good search, I have to go to the library because it's so limited in what I can bring up at home.
And I don't know how to combat that. Jeremy, do you have any advice for that? Because for me, it just kind of fixed itself. I was at such a bad place in life where, you know, I wasn't going to survive if things didn't start getting better.
Right.
This was when I had no income. I lived with handlers. They were very abusive. My ex-husband was very abusive. I was severely injured and walking with a cane. You know, so things were very, very bad. If I could have been able to fight that, I didn't even think about, like, I didn't understand that there was support available to me because I couldn't find it until the people that are screwing with me the most decided that, okay, if we don't do something, then she's not going to survive this. And they're not trying to kill us, they're killing us for a reason. And they led me to this group of people who are targeted. Do you
the
know
FFCH?
Of any way? Hmm?
You mean they led you to FFCHS?
Yeah, that was the first thing, yep.
How did that happen?
I can't really tell that story on a recorded call. I was led to FFCHS.
Why I asked is because I feel like I was led there too, and that's why I was wondering, because there was no reason in the world for me to have found the group, you know?
Right. Oh, no, there was for me, because I don't think I would have survived otherwise. And
right,
I believe that they want us to have support because they're not trying to kill us.
Yeah, no, I mean that there would have, I had never heard of, you know, directed beam weaponry. I had never heard of any of this. I thought that it was a personal thing in the circumstance that I was in. So there would have been no reason for me to be searching out a support group. I just stumbled on it by accident when I was looking something else up. It came up on the screen. I was looking for something else and it came up on the screen and I said, what is this? Because it had the description of gang stalking, but I wasn't, you know, I had never heard of any of this. So that's why I kind of felt like they must have led me to it, because why was it on the screen?
Well, maybe that's why I wasn't finding anything, because in the beginning, that's another possibility, is that I was looking up like mafia, because I felt like this had to be the mafia, and then also government, because of this NSA thing.
Mm-hmm.
Before I saw the NSA.oh.reg providing my internet, I never really thought about the NSA very much, you know, or any. I thought of CIA a little bit just because of some of the memories I'd had at that point. But I thought, what the hell is this, you know?
Right.
But based on other things that were going on at the same time, like real-time things, not just memories I was having, I was like, man, I'm involved in something pretty intense. And when I went to, I went overseas a couple of times, which this was used to discredit and set me up, I think, even though it hasn't worked, really. I went overseas, and just the things that happened there made me think that I was involved in something pretty deep that I didn't understand. And obviously I had amnesia and I knew it. When I went to the Middle East, I knew I had amnesia. I was looking for answers. And at one hotel, I was actually on New Year's Eve. A guy came up and he sat down. I was crying because of what was happening around me, and I won't go into great detail about that. It turned out to be a lot different. So it's too long of a story to go into right now. But he came up and he asked me what was wrong, and I told him what was going on, and he said, "You're involved in something that's way over your head." And that was all he said. And then he was like, he said, "You know, I wish you the best and peace be with you." And he took off. But he was right. I was at that point. It was so over my head, I could not wrap my head around it at all. I hadn't found this group or any information. I was just doing my own research. And I thought I had to go to the Middle East to do it because of what some people were telling me, who were very misleading, by the way. It was a wild goose chase that I was sent on, and I'm sure there were other reasons for that too. But for me, personally, it was a wild goose chase in the end. And portions of it were pretty nice. It was pretty cool, some of the places I went to. Because I try to always just make the best out of everything, even when I'm being used in a way that I would never volunteer for.
Can you talk about why you went to the Middies?
Well, I was manipulated to go there. And when I first arrived in Dubai, it was New Year's Eve. And when I got off the plane, the American Embassy had already been alerted by my family that I was coming there. Well, actually by my ex-husband and my mother. They said that I was coming there and that I was very dangerous and that I should be taken to a hospital immediately. Sheikh Hamadan, and I can't go into other details of while I was there. Not yet. But I was there with a companion, a travel companion. And once we got to the hotel and we got checked in, he took off into an elevator, and that's when the American Embassy showed up. I went up to my room where I thought he was going to, and he wasn't there. And the next thing you know, Sheikh Hamadan is at the door on New Year's Eve saying, "We hear that you are a danger." And I invited him in. He had a bunch of other people with him because they thought I was dangerous. And military people, military police and whatever. So he comes in and we talked. I told him what was really going on, why I was there and all that. And I was studying Islam at the time, so I was like a practicing Muslim. And I was explaining these sorts of things to him and why I was there and that I had amnesia and I was trying to understand my past and blah, blah, blah. Well, in the end of this meeting with him, he ended up saying, "There's nothing wrong with you." And I told him that I had been traveling for 23 hours to get there and that I hadn't slept and I needed to get some sleep and I needed to take a shower and then I just wanted to enjoy my time there in Dubai. And he agreed. He said, "There's nothing wrong with Miss Temi. Miss Temi needs shower. Miss Temi needs..." And he left a guard at the door with me. And after he left, then my travel companion showed back up again, who is a handler. And that's why I'm not going to go into great detail about that right now.
Right.
But yeah, then another trip I took, I can't talk about it all publicly, but I went to the Middle East again, and it was very bad, way worse than that. Yeah, it was a wild goose chase, basically, which I see happening to lots of people who are targeted. We're led in all kinds of different directions that lead to nowhere, you know?
Right.
Yeah, we waste our time. And not that I look back on those things as a waste of time, because they were one of them is very regretful. But at the same time, a learning experience or whatever, something I could talk about someday. But, you know, we don't need to waste our time. We got to learn from our past mistakes. And for me, one of the mistakes I've made along the way is going on wild goose chases based on faulty leads. And convincing me to go to the Middle East, both times it took 6 months just to convince me to go. Not that the people working on me didn't do everything they could to isolate me. They turned family and friends against me. Without my knowledge, I didn't understand why people were turning against me. I couldn't wrap my head around it. And it made me increasingly upset and increasingly determined to figure out why. So I had to understand my past. And then I was fed a lot of nonsense and a lot of truth that sounds like nonsense. And that's why I can't talk about it.
When they were convincing you, were they using V2K?
I don't get V2K. And if I have had it in the past, I can't talk about that. There was all kinds of different tactics used. Ton of electronic harassment. Mm-hmm. Everything you can think of was used to manipulate me into doing these things. Everything you can think of. It was a huge struggle for me because I tried not to. I tried not to go along with this, even though I didn't even understand myself at the time because I was still recovering from amnesia. This was 2006, turning into 2007 New Year's, that I did the second trip to the Middle East. And the first one was I was only recovering from amnesia for about a year when I went over there. So I had 4 years of memory when I went. And, yeah, they used every kind of electronic thing you could think of, and there was a lot of physical contact and, you know, like I was in person with the people a lot that were really pulling the strings, and they were really making things happen. Like people with a lot of pull and a lot of credibility and a lot of resources at their hands to make these sort of things happen.
So at the end, are you going to book someday?
Well, I intend to one day when people stop treating me like a leper because of what I've gone through. Then I intend to spill my guts, yeah. I mean, I'm going to spill my guts thoroughly, but they keep me involved in litigation and things that could destroy me more just to keep
right.
me shut up, you know, to
right.
keep me quiet. And it's effective because I don't ever want to hurt my kids
right.
because of my past with experimentation and military planning and different horrible things that I've been involved in since just for so long, I can't even go into it on this call.
Right.
But yeah, I think just if I were to just write a book about my experience as a Muslim, which I was only Muslim for 2 years, and that was post-amnesia, I mean full amnesia, I would be able to write a whole book on just that 2 years alone. And then if you go back through the whole history, like my trip to Turkey, that'd be a whole nother book in itself. My trip to Dubai would be a book. My trip to California would be a book. You know, like it's very hard to tell these stories. And then just things that have happened in between all of those trips, just things that I have experienced from day to day, because, you know, as a target, they will, if they're going to pack it on real heavy, when we're in the middle of the COINTELPRO operation where they're using you to discredit yourself, basically.
Right.
And
right.
at the same time going with the slander campaign. That time, I would have like 7 incidents a day of drama. Drama on top of trauma is more trauma, more drama. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're already in a trauma state and people are being dramatic around you, then that becomes trauma on top of it. A lot mm-hmm. of that has calmed down for me now, though. Like my biggest problem at this point would be what's going on with the kids.
Right.
People, because of the recording devices, they live on anything they would say to my face. So that's gone. You know, a lot of the electronic harassment has tampered down. That's gone too. Now I'm just dealing with being separated from my kids, which is enough of a trauma for a mom to
right.
satisfy the traumatizer,
yeah.
I'd imagine, because it is. It's the most devastating thing I've ever been through.
Definitely.
Although people who've heard my full story say I've been through much worse, not in my mind. I'd go through those things again. You know, I'd go through that stuff again because it would last probably about a month if you added it all up without long hospital stays and stuff like that. Okay, I guess I wouldn't go through it all again.
Well, I don't think there's anything that hurts a person's soul more than losing their kids.
No. No. I mean, this has been the most devastating blow of them all, and I think they can lay off in other arenas because of that. And if they don't, I probably wouldn't survive it, and they know that, you know?
But that is part of what they do for people that are in one of the programs. Kathleen Sullivan in her book talks about that, about part of the programming of people that are in government programs, that's one of their, they know the devastation that losing your children does to you, and so that's one of the things they do to people who are, that have been in the program since childhood, since birth.
Yep.
That are created for their soldiers.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It's tough, and it's nonstop. It is from childhood. It's one trauma after another, and it's very extremely hard to live through. And that's why I think when things are getting extremely tough, they lay off, because something bad might happen and they'll lose one of their favorite experimentees, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or people that they can use in a certain way that is very, very profitable to them. Very profitable.
Can you explain that a little bit? I'm not understanding that part of it.
Well, that's one of those things I'd love to spill my guts on, but can't. But I could use somebody else as an example. I can't tell my story on that right now,
mm-hmm.
just because of what's going on with the court. I would love to tell that story publicly, and I will. But I would say, like, what's going on with James Walbert, he had a very, very good idea for an invention, and he had it patented. And when they saw it, they wanted it because they knew it was a very good idea and it was going to make tons and tons of money. So now they want to get rid of him so that they can take his idea. I mean, it's too deep to go into on this call. I can't go into it. But they take biological property from some people, and they take intellectual property from others, and then there's even others that they take both from, biological and intellectual property. And the more you have to offer them, the harder your targeting is going to be. They can get a marketing stance on you. If they can get good information from a marketing standpoint, then okay, you might not get horrible targeting. They're just going to kind of watch what you're buying and what you're doing and what they can influence you to buy or do and how those methods work. But now if you have biological property they can take from you, you're their slave. If you have intellectual property that they can take from you, you're going to be a target because they want it before you can act on it.
And when you say biological, are you talking about something in your physiology that they want?
Oh, I'm talking about all kinds of different things. Let's say you have very good organs and they need one.
Mm-hmm.
What if one of them needs a lung and you have the perfect lung and the perfect blood type? Then they can take that. If they just, you know, arrange a nice accident and you're controlled to be an organ donor,
mm-hmm.
then they get it because mm-hmm. they're at the top of the list and they got the most money and they arranged the whole thing anyway. Well, that would be one example that might sound wacko to some people, but I know people in our position know that that's possible with all the doctoring that goes on of records. So that's one of the things that they could do. Then there's also blood types. If there's a rare blood type and they're one of those blood types, they want your blood, so they might want to get you in the hospital. That's like an extreme case, though. That's pretty extreme.
I just read a book called Healy, and it was about the first cells that they were ever able to keep alive and multiply. And it's a fascinating book, but in it, it talks about a case where there are people that have a rare plasma in their blood that can be used universal. It's not the blood type, it's a plasma. And only, you know, not many people produce it. But when they find someone that does, they won't tell them. They'll have them continue to donate their blood and then they sell it on the open, the company will sell it on the open market. And the reason why the woman brought it up is this one guy had a good doctor who said, you know, you have this plasma, your body makes this plasma, you know, you better be careful because manufacturers will go after you and they'll ask you to donate and not tell you, and then they turn around and sell your plasma and make a lot of money. And
right.
He found out that was happening and he sued the company And then opened his own company and got together other people that did that, and so they're all able to profit off of their bodies.
Here's another way that they do it too, Linda. People wonder why that these cults and these sorts of things, like blonde hair, blue eyes, are light-eyed people in general. And that is because, especially girls, but they like the sperm of men that have those qualities too. And this could be a reason for lost time. Could be. I'm just hypothesizing here. They will want the eggs of those girls because they're worth a lot of money. If you can make a profile of the person, and the better, the more you have to add to that profile, the better. Let's say it's a creative person. It's somebody with really high creativity with a nice portfolio of different things that they've done creatively, artwork. And then they also have a very high IQ. They have light hair and light eyes that later they had dark hair, but the light eyes never went. If the eyes turn from one color to another and back and forth, these are all desirable qualities for people who don't have those qualities but have a whole lot of money. That's another use for biological property. Then there's intellectual property. The thievery on that is just astounding, that they will steal inventions and ideas, and they look for creative people to take these things from in their market research groups and all different kinds of ways, and even mental institutions if they find a very creative person. And they're one of the researchers that is working for the corporation.
Right.
Then they're going to flag that person as somebody we can rob intellectually.
Right.
Yeah. Then to discredit the person, they can use that their own targeting against them. So that's something extreme, and I don't know how many targets are going through that. I would think it would be more MKUltra than just average targets. Jeremy, if you have anything else to say, any questions from the chat or anything? I haven't been paying attention.
No, there's nothing really happening in the chat. It's difficult to talk about this stuff when you're in the middle of a legal battle. You're restrained in what you can say, and I hope anyone listening in understands that there's just certain territory that we can't cover. I'd love to come back someday and do an unabridged interview. I'm sure that would be fascinating for everyone.
Yeah. And you'll be the first.
Thank you. But today, this is what we're talking about is what people see to their face.
We have a question coming in from New York. New York? Oh, that's Lola.
Hi, Tammy. I have a question, but I don't want to be recorded, so maybe I can talk to you later.
Okay, yeah, we'll take the question off air. I'm going to end the recording right now. But I'm going to mute everybody's line to wrap it up for right now, and then after I terminate the recording, I'll open everybody back up again. Thanks for joining us today and for all of your questions and insights. Thanks again to
Luther for helping me start today's show. Don't forget to tune in next week when we'll be joined by Canadian celebrity Stephen Shellen. Today, we're going to close with a tribute to the mainstream media. Bill O'Reilly of Fox's No Spin Zone will give us a glimpse into their world, a wonderful testimony to the behind-the-scenes nature of the mainstream media. Thank you, Bill. Please play us out.
5, 4, 3. Fuck it. There's no tomorrow. Fuck it. We'll do it live. Fuck it.
I've never seen that.
Fuck it. Things suck. There's no words there.
Fuck it.
There's no words tomorrow.
Fuck it.
We'll do it live.
Fuck it. I've never seen that.
Fuck it. Things suck. There's no words there.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Fuck. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Fuck. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Fuck. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what.
Go. Go. I can't do it.
Fuck it.
Go. Go. I can't do it.
Fuck.
Go, I can't do it.
Fuck. Thanks again for watching.
Fuck.
There's no word line tomorrow.
Fuck it.
We'll do it live.
Fuck it. I've never seen that.
Fuck it. Things suck. There's no words there.
Fuck it.
There's no word line tomorrow.
Fuck it.
We'll do it live.
Fuck it. I've never seen that.
Fuck it. Things suck. There's no words there.
Okay. Take it away.
Go. Yeah. Go. Yeah. Go. Yeah. Fuck.
go home.